If you've been watching the news this last week, you've seen much about the war in Israel. I know it's raised a lot of concerns, a lot of questions. Some Christians want to know if this is the fulfillment of biblical prophecy. And that's not the point of the message today, but the answer is no, it's not. We can talk about that more later if you have further questions on that. Some people want to know if this is the beginning of World War III. And this message is also not about that, but just a quick reminder, every news organization on radio, television, and the internet is selling you news. They are making money off your interest. And so they're going to do whatever they can to package the news in a way that's going to grab your attention. And the way they do that is attempting to stir fear, anger, and other strong emotions. And so as you follow the news of these events, be careful not to let the media manipulate you, not just by lies, but by emotions. Remember to think biblically and soberly about everything that you are hearing. And I start with all of that because the sermon today is about the sovereignty of God over the nations of the world. Now, I did not plan this message to coincide with the conflicts in the Middle East, but it certainly fits very well when we remember that all that is happening in the Ukraine, the Middle East, Africa, and every other troubled part of the world is under God's direct control. And that's what Habakkuk 2 tells us. God is working in those events to accomplish His perfect will. And this section of Habakkuk is a prophecy of judgment on the Empire of Babylon. So we see in this chapter a description of Babylon's sins and then the consequences of those sins. One of the themes that underlies all of this is that God brings judgment on Babylon. God has the authority to bring judgment on Babylon because He is the ruler of all nations. It is His right to call every government to account. And so keep the sovereignty of God over the nations of the world in the front of your mind as you watch the news and as you listen to the sermon today. God rules every kingdom and every authority in this world, whether it be ancient Babylon or modern Hamas, Israel, America, or Argentina. He rules them all. I will say as well, Habakkuk 2 is not a particularly happy portion of scriptures. And it deals with some subjects that I am not going to examine in any depth. The historical details of Babylon's depravity are not pleasant reading. And it's not necessary to explore the depths of their wickedness this morning. And even though the subject matter is somewhat unpleasant, it's definitely challenging to us, we are wise. We're wise to consider the sin of the Babylonian Empire. We're wise to consider God's judgment of them. And so this passage is shaped by five woes. You'll see that phrase five times. Woe to him. These five woes condemn the sin of the Babylonians and they announce the judgment for each of those sins. So it's very similar in every woe. There's this same kind of thing going on. There's also considerable overlap between the sins. And so even though we're describing it in five woes, and I'm going to highlight five specific aspects, we're going to find that these things are really all woven together. As is the case with all sin, the sin of Babylon is, it's tangled up. It's not just one. Sin never stands alone. It always brings along another and then another. It feeds off all of these other sins to grow stronger and more difficult to correct. Sin is never a loner hanging out on the street corner making a nuisance of himself. Sin travels in gangs. roaming the town, mugging innocent people, burglarizing stores, and turning a nice place to live into a ghetto. And that's what this describing here, this gang of sins. It's not the full list of their sin, but it's the primary members of that gang. And so that those five primary sins for which in Babylon is indicted by God are pride, covetousness, violence, exploitation, and idolatry. And this prophecy here is presented as what's called a taunting song, sung by the people who had suffered under Babylon's rule. You see that in verse 6 particularly. Will not all these take up a proverb against him and a taunting riddle against him? So these woes are a poetic description of the wickedness of Babylon. They picture Babylon as if it was one man committing all of these sins. And the indictment is absolutely accurate in every detail, but we need to remember its poetic nature so that we cannot think that every Babylonian or every Babylonian official was guilty of all the things described in this chapter. And even though Habakkuk 2 speaks of Babylon as one man, it is the condemnation here is not limited to one man, to a king or a prime minister or some particularly wicked advisor. It's a poetic condemnation of the entire empire. And so the first woe is found in verses 4 through 8. It starts by saying, "Behold the proud. His soul is not upright in him, but the just shall live by his faith. Indeed, because he transgresses by wine, he is a proud man, and he does not stay at home. Because he enlarges, his desire is hell, and he is like death, and cannot be satisfied. He gathers to himself all nations, and heaps up for himself all peoples. Will not all these take up a proverb against him and a taunting riddle against him and say, 'Woe to him who increases what is not his. How long? And to him who loads himself with many pledges. Will not your creditors rise up suddenly? Will they not awaken who oppress you, and you will become their booty? Because you have plundered many nations, all the remnant of the people shall plunder you. Because of men's blood and the violence of the land and the city and of all who dwell in it.'" So the first woe here is the pride of Babylon. It's a greedy, voracious pride that can never be satisfied no matter how much he owns. This greedy pride manifests itself in violence, indebtedness, theft, and drunkenness. And we're actually going to see all those same sins in the later woes, the following condemnation. So it really is, it's almost a summary of everything else that's to follow. But as I said last week, at the root of all of the sin of Babylon is great pride. It starts off, verse 4, "Behold the proud." Verse 5, "Indeed, because he transgresses by wine, he is a proud man and does not stay at home." Pride was at the root of everything else that follows. And pride was, in my opinion, is at the root of every sin ever committed. Pride was certainly the sin of Lucifer. He sought to make himself as great as God. And because of his arrogance, he was cast out of his glorious position in heaven. He then became known as Satan, the adversary. As the adversary of God and man, he worked to pit man against God. And he accomplished it. He did so by appealing to Eve's pride. He promised her that she could become like God. And so her desire to be God-like led her to disobey God. And those two pride-filled sins are the fountain from which every other sin flows. And I believe this is true in every individual's life. Whenever you sin, you can look deeper and you can find a proud desire for personal gratification at the root of every single sin. Therefore, Pride is the chief of sins, and it is utterly abominable to God. And I'm not going to say any more about pride this morning except this. God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. If you would walk closely with God, you must be humble. Because Babylon was proud, his soul was not upright. He was displeasing to God and pursued all that was opposed to God. Even further, alcohol was the fuel that drove much of his treacherous dealings with others. Arrogant Babylon got drunk, and his drunkenness inflamed his pride so that he goes out on a rampage seeking to prove just how tough he really was. He was ready to fight anyone and anything because he had to show that he is better than everyone else. He stumbled out into the street, and his pride and his greed worked together so that now he picks up a brick and throws it through a store window and carries away a 70-inch TV. He then staggers into somebody's home and takes whatever he can get his hand on. But Babylon was more than just a petty criminal. He was a vicious, hardened thug, breaking into houses, tying up families, beating the father, holding everyone captive while he takes every valuable out of the house. He does all of this, that's verse 5, cannot be satisfied, plundering the nations. He does all of this under the enslaving influence of arrogance and alcohol. So he was a proud drunk who ran after the satisfaction of his own desires. And in his pride, his desires were never satisfied. Which we know this to be true. There's no ultimate satisfaction in how much you get. There's no ultimate satisfaction in how many people praise you or how great your fame grows. And Babylon found the poverty of wealth. And so he went out and robbed his neighbors again, destroyed more of their homes. He heaped up to himself mounds of goods, but was still never satisfied. And so what does he do? The end of verse 6, he loads himself with many pledges. He goes into debt. What he can't steal, he buys. What he can't afford, he purchases on credit. He keeps borrowing until he is financially leveraged beyond his ability to repay. So that the nation's debt increases and increases until suddenly the country owes $33 trillion. And the only way to keep it from falling into financial ruin is for its legislators to raise the maximum allowable debt every time the country gets to the previously set maximum allowable debt. Does any of that sound familiar? That's the same kind of thing that we see in Babylon. And that scene of pride and drunkenness and greed is played out in nations across the world, but not just in nations, it's played out in millions of homes every year. And this portion tells us that God will judge everyone, whether king or kingdom, CEO or laborer, God will judge them all for the pride-fueled greed. And the judgment that God issues is this taunting, this plundering by the very ones that they plundered. The people it once robbed and enslaved would rise up against them to scorn them. You may remember when Saddam Hussein was overthrown, executed, and his statue torn down. Those people that were once under Hussein's rule rose up against him. They mocked him and they cheered when he was punished for his many wicked deeds. That's what God promised would happen to Babylon. The Babylonian Empire would be conquered by those it formerly oppressed, and they would denounce it. They would cheer its destruction and denounce it for its evil. The next indictment is the covetousness of Babylon. Verse 9, woe to him who covets evil gain for his house, that he may set his nest on high, that he may be delivered from the power of disaster. You give shameful counsel to your house, cutting off many peoples in sin against your soul. For the stone will cry out from the wall, and the beam from the timbers will answer it. This covetousness of Babylon is not just the desire for goods, though that's a big part of it. It's a desire for goods, thinking they will make them secure. It is a trust in goods for security. We see this at work sometimes today in those who covet a large retirement account. Now, other people who covet a large collection of firearms. Now, there's nothing wrong with having a retirement account. There's nothing wrong with owning a firearm. And there's a lot of things in between that we desire. And the problem is not necessarily the thing. It's the problem is, what are you wanting it to do? You see, if the expectation is that it will protect you from the troubles of this life, I want this so that I will be safe, then that is covetousness. It is seeking security in goods rather than in God. Now, I'm not saying there's something wrong with planning wisely. It's a whole different ballgame. But when my ultimate trust is in the possession, if I just reach this dollar amount in my retirement fund, my life will be great, I will be content. It's covetousness. Now my contentment and my peace is resting in my money or some other possession that I have. And the Babylonian here, verse 9, is pictured as setting his nest on high. If you drive west out of here, and drive out by the Fish Dam River, there's a telephone pole out there on the south side of the highway with a large nest on top of it. And the osprey is one of many birds that build their nest in those high, inaccessible places. And being that far off the ground is a good plan. It's a strong protection against predators. And the Babylonians are pictured in just that way. They're pictured like a bird that's building its nest in a high place, thinking that the position of their houses, the fortifications that they have, would secure them. And even worse, they did not build their security by their own profitable labors. But rather, he is coveting evil gain. He is cutting off many people. He is gaining his security, or seeking his security, by overthrowing those around them. And this was shameful counsel. This was godless advice. It's counsel like that a schoolyard bully would follow. Babylon promoted itself by knocking down others. And not only was their counsel, that counsel, wicked, it was futile. None are ever made more secure by violence, oppression, and injustice. Modern history shows this to be true. Review the history of the 20th century. And you see that the nations who sought to secure themselves by oppressing the nations around them really tended to bring greater troubles. Certainly today, one nation's abuse of another is likely to bring intense opposition from other nations of the world. In ancient times, that wasn't so much the case. There's no UN back BC. But what we do know, what is clear, is that God will judge those nations who build their power at the expense of others. Whether it was BC, AD, or right now, God will judge those nations which violently oppress and mistreat others around them, so that even the very stones in the Babylonians' walls, every beam in their houses was a silent testimony against Babylon, declaring their violence towards others, so that the sticks and stones testified the slave labor that cut the rock out of the quarry, laid the stones in the walls, and hung the beams on the roofs. So the things which Babylon trusted to make them secure would one day be evidence against them of their cruelty. It would show that their crimes were aggravated by all this incredible violence. And then the third woe, verse 12. Woe to him who builds a town with bloodshed, who establishes a city by iniquity. Behold, is it not of the Lord of hosts that the peoples labor to feed the fire, and nations weary themselves in vain? For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. This third woe is very specifically upon the violence of the nation of Babylon. Flowing out of that second one, we see that they built their cities with bloodshed and injustice. And throughout this book, we have seen the cruelty of the Babylonians. Chapter 1 calls them terrible and dreadful. They were fierce, hastening after violence and gathering slaves to themselves like heaps of sand. They were treacherous. They treated the people of the world as no more valuable than a nest of wasps. They plundered the nations. They shed the blood of many men. They slaughtered tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands of people. And the great empire Babylon was built on death and destruction. And their judgment was that all that they labored for was just fuel for the fire. The tens of thousands of slaves worked hundreds of thousands of hours to build cities, temples, and monuments that would become nothing more than kindling. All of their labors were empty and worthless. It was of the Lord of hosts that all their labor went to feed the fire. God had said it's not going to stand. Now, at the time Habakkuk was written, the empire of Babylon boasted some incredible structures. The capital city housed a tower that many associated with the biblical Tower of Babel, or the remnants of it. The city also had an astounding gate. I won't describe it to you today, but an astounding gate known as the Ishtar Gate. This still remains. It's in a museum in Berlin. You can see it's beautiful. It's incredible. Most famously, Babylon was home to the Hanging Gardens, one of those seven ancient wonders of the world. What is left of all the magnificence of Babylon? Have you heard the poem of Ozymandias? I hope you're paying attention, because this is probably the only poem you will ever hear me read, outside of a hymnal. But the poem says, I met a traveler from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive, stamped on those lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal, these words appear, my name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round that decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sand stretch far away. That is what happened to Babylon's mighty power and great structures. God condemned all of Babylon's great works to be made desolate, so that nothing remains today but ruins in the sand and a few museum pieces, lonely mementos of a once great empire because of the judgment of God. The fourth woe is against Babylon for its exploitation of people. Verse 15, woe to him who gives drink to his neighbor, pressing him to your bottle, even to make him drunk, that you may look on his nakedness. You are filled with shame instead of glory. You also drink, and be exposed as uncircumcised. The cup of the Lord's right hand will be turned against you, and utter shame will be on your glory. For the violence done to Lebanon will cover you, and the plunder of beasts which made them afraid because of men's blood, and the violence of the land and the city and of all who dwell in it. Babylon is simply described as getting the nations drunk to expose their nakedness. They were panderers who engaged in human trafficking for every conceivable purpose. Those they could not enslave, they manipulated into doing their will. And I've heard that still today, people are coerced into engaging in lewd or obscene behavior by first getting them drunk or high. And Babylon is described as that same kind of vile creep who would willfully impair the faculties of another and then take advantage of that person for Babylon's own perverse gratification. And God says He is going to judge Babylon for its exploitation by causing it to be shamed in the same way it abused others. The King James Version says at the end of verse 16, shameful spewing will be on their glory. The nation which made other nations drunk was now made drunk itself. The nation which exposed others was now exposed and ashamed before others. Babylon would end up like a drunken reveler, lying naked in the gutter and covered in its own vomit. All its gold and glory would be made filthy and shameful. If you're familiar with the book of Daniel, you may remember that the night the city of Babylon was conquered, its king was hosting a drunken party. Daniel 5 says, Belshazzar the king made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in the presence of 1,000. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze and iron, wood and stone. And they got completely hammered. That's hidden in the Hebrew there, but they were absolutely drunk. And it tells us the end of Daniel 5, that very night Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain. Their king was drinking and partying while the city was being assaulted. And the kingdom was lost that very same night. All of their glory was turned to shame. The last woe is for Babylon's idolatry. What profit is the image that its maker should carve it? The molded image, a teacher of lies that the maker of its mold should trust in it to make mute idols. Woe to him who says to wood, awake. And to silent stone, arise, it shall teach. Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, yet in it there is no breath at all. Idolatry was, I would say, alongside of pride, was at the heart of Babylon's sin. And this is a major, major subject in Scripture. It's one of the largest themes in the Bible. And so what I'm going to do is take all of next week to consider this important topic. And so we're actually not going to talk about idolatry at all, but just to point it out to us. But as we conclude today, what do you and I take away from these words of judgment? These are words about an ancient empire that's long been gone. What do we learn from this? The first thing I would say is remember that God is perfectly, strictly, and carefully just. God would not require a criminal pay $1 more than justice demands. He would not sentence anyone to jail for one day longer than justice requires. The judgment of God always and exactly fits the sin committed. You may have noticed as we are going through this that in every case, the judgment of God was very specific to the sin committed. So that their sin was essentially turned back on them. We see this in the book of Revelation. We are told that the waters of earth are turned to blood because the kingdom of the Antichrist shed the blood of the saints of God. And the way it's put is, if they would drink up the blood of God's people, then God is going to give them blood to drink. God's justice is always exact. So the proud will be brought low. The covetous will be overthrown by the very goods they are relying upon. The violent will be violently destroyed, and the exploiter will be shamed. God's justice is always exact. You will reap what you sow. And so we remember, as a psalm that Dennis read earlier mentioned, God is righteous in all of his works. That is just in all that he is doing. And with that, we must remember, and we must actively remember, that God is the sovereign judge of all the nations. The Old Testament prophets show us that God ruled sovereignly over all the peoples of the world. The New Testament teaches the same truth, that today God still rules and judges the nations of the world. We dare not act as if God is uninvolved in the kingdoms of this world. We dare not think that God is somehow removed from the events. Acts 17, verse 26 is very clear that God raises up and overthrows kingdoms. He gives them a set boundary and a set duration of existence so that no nation is exempt from God's rule. In Old Testament times, we see that God did not limit his judgment just to the nation of Israel. He was not ruler of Israel alone. He rules all nations. Today, God does not limit his judgments and rule to only those nations which claim to be Christians. God does not only bring his judgment on those nations which persecute his children. God is the ruler and judge of every nation, which means that Russia will be held to account for every one of its sins. This means that Iran will be judged for every one of its sins. This means Israel will be judged for all of its sins. This means America will be judged for every single sin. So whether we're talking about England, Luxembourg, Mozambique, New Zealand, or Canada, God is judge of all, and he will hold every single nation to account. Therefore, we do not fear. We remember that God is sovereign. He is orchestrating events in this world to accomplish his perfect will. He will hold every wicked nation accountable. He will reward any righteous nation. We do not have to fear. We do not despair that things are getting out of hand. Yes, we absolutely grieve sin. We grieve injustice and cruelty. And yet as Christians, we cannot dread the future, because God, in his sovereign rule, is bringing all things about in accord with his will, his perfect plan. And in his justice, God will destroy all that is evil. And that coming justice teaches us to live for what really matters. Why would we spend our lives on those things which are under God's wrath and sentenced to God's destruction? And this is an incredible comfort. If you read anything about the persecuted church, you'll see that this was a rich comfort to those that are being persecuted by their governments. It should also be a great warning to us. We're not afflicted by our government. We enjoy a wide range of blessings. We need to remember, though, that this nation, all the treasures of this world, will be destroyed. All of it's gone. This here, this building, like the cars in a parking lot, Whatever's in your bank account, it's fuel for the fire. And so we hold loosely to those things because they're not the things that matter. And we cling tightly to the eternal things, recognizing that the things of God are the things that matter, the things that will remain. We do not lay up our treasures on earth, but we must lay them up in heaven, because all that is here is absolutely scheduled for destruction. The last thing I would say from this, that we must be warned. We must forsake the sin of the nations. God hates all sin. And as Christians, we must flee sin. Babylon's pride, greed, drunkenness, covetousness, oppressive indebtedness, injustice, violence, self-sufficiency, and idolatry are not just ancient sins. They are incredibly modern. Nor are these just limited to the unsaved. I do not want us to hear this message and think, boy, all those people out there are really bad. Colossians chapter 3, verse 5 says, therefore, put to death your members which are on the earth, fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. Doesn't that sound a lot like the list of sins in Babylon? And Colossians was not written to a pagan nation. It was written to a Christian church. And he is calling and warning the believers to forsake the same kinds of sins. And we need to be warned over and over and over again to put away the sins of this world, the things that our nation loves and races after. We must forsake. And one of the reasons is because those are under the wrath of God. Colossians 3:6 says, because of these things, the wrath of God is coming upon the sons of disobedience. Why should we forsake sin? Because God is and will judge all sin. He hates it all, and His wrath is being poured out on men because of their sin. As Christians, we must simply hate the things God hates. We must hate them. We must not embrace them. We must not cozy up to them. We must not relish them. We must forsake them. Because those are the reasons that He is condemning the world. And so we must learn from the folly of Babylon. Forsake pride. Forsake covetousness. Forsake greed. Forsake drunkenness. Forsake self-sufficiency. Forsake all which God hates to live a life that is pleasing to Him.